Hello, this is Mary Moylan reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 24th, 2025. The front page article of the News Gazette, Mahomet Mobile Home Park sues over violations. Candlewood Estates owner says they don't pose risk. Judge says it must first apply to have license renewed. A Mahomet Mobile Home Park has filed a complaint against the Illinois Department of Public Health, claiming the 482 electrical code violations identified on the property do not pose a significant health or safety problem. Candlewood Manufactured Home Community, LLC, owner of Candlewood Estates, argues that it should not be required to pay to move electrical distribution panels in the park, and the state agency should not deny renewal of its operating license. In a Wednesday morning hearing on the complaint, Champaign County Judge Jason Boehm denied Candlewood's request, saying if it wants to argue that it should be granted an operating license, it must first apply for that license. All of this starts with proper application for renewal, and that, it's undisputed, hasn't occurred here, Boehm said. I don't see how we can draw the conclusion that you are going to be improperly denied something that you haven't applied for. As of Wednesday's hearing, Candlewood had still not applied for license renewal. The current license is set to expire April 30th. Candlewood attorney Blake Stubbs of Chicago cited an email from the state agency saying that its license would not be renewed, so the company didn't bother to apply. Assistant State's Attorney Matt Bonick said while he did not yet file to have the case dismissed, the matter isn't within the court's jurisdiction, as Candlewood should go through the standard application and appeals process before elevating it to the circuit court level. Kevin Jacobs, Assistant General Counsel for the state agency, said that as long as a mobile home park is going through that application and appeals process, its current permit will be considered active and residents will not be affected. He also said that even if the park were to lose its license, the agency is very unlikely to attempt to close Candlewood because of the concerns about displacing residents of hundreds of homes. Stubbs said Candlewood also legally cannot evict tenants if its license expires, but it would also no longer be able to legally operate the park. According to email from the Public Health Department to Candlewood staff from the agency's Champaign Regional Office, investigated the park on August 8th in response to a complaint regarding conditions of the electrical service connections serving homes within the community. The investigation uncovered 482 violations across 352 occupied home sites. Of those violations, 123 were considered Type C, which the agency described as involving life safety. Those included 75 sites where outdoor electrical equipment was not weatherproof, 12 conductors that were either hung below proper vertical clearance levels or left emerging from the ground without protective enclosures, and 36 electrical systems that otherwise not maintained in a safe condition. The remaining violations included service equipment that was inaccessible or wasn't secured at least 12 inches above grade. Stubbs said that as far as Candlewood's current management knows, none of these concerns have been previously raised in the last 30-plus years. In the complaint, Candlewood said it would not have bought the park in 2022 or would have paid much less for it if it had known it would be expected to pay $500 to $1,000 per home to resolve the violations. The state agency first notified Candlewood of the violations on August 13th, including a spreadsheet detailing the violation type at each home site, and informed the company it would be fined up to $16,850 every day that it did not resolve the violations. On September 13th, Candlewood Community Manager Chris Flessner noted residents via email of the code violations found at their lots and said the homeowners were responsible for maintenance of their electrical systems from the point at which the electric supply is delivered from the meter to the home. He said this aligns with Candlewood's rules and regulations, which residents agreed to as part of their leases. Flessner told homeowners they had 10 days to complete remediation, and if they did not, the park would have the work done and bill the homeowners for it. 5 days later, the state agency served Candlewood a notice to cease and desist instructing Tennis to correct or pay for the violations, saying the instructions violated the Illinois Landlord and Tenants' Rights Act. Stubbs argued that because it was in the agreement made with tenants, it was allowed. Bonnet countered that the debate shouldn't happen in a courtroom unless the tenants were named part of the complaint and could be represented during arguments. He described the tenants as people of modest means who would be made to pay thousands of dollars if Candlewood had its way. That was their selling ticket coming to the Court of Equities, saying, "Judge, please give us a green light to do these things to the park residents," Bonnock said. "That can be referred to in many colorful terms that I'm sure the residents have already thought of and expressed plenty of." On March 4th, local electrician Dave Parsons wrote that he has worked in Candlewood for over 20 years and has never run into any problem with any disconnects that were less than 12 inches off the ground, and these disconnects are 25 to 40 years old. He acknowledged that current National Electrical Code standards state that disconnects must be at least 12 inches above ground, but said he has never seen disconnects that are lower than that with cover plates cause problems or pose significant health or safety threats. Bonnock said he plans to file a motion to dismiss. Bohm said a dismissal would have to be considered at a future date, and he doesn't see a likelihood of success for Candlewood's complaint. There's a photo on the front page of the News Gazette with the caption, "University of Illinois President Timothy Colleen, in costume as the mayor of Westerntown, chats with Todd Salen and another guest Wednesday at the opening reception of Eberfest at the U of I President's House in Urbana." The reception had a Western theme in honor of the screening that evening of the 1956 John Wayne film, The Searchers. Vote set on new elections vendor. Current one did not bid for renewal. New one comes with $415,000 in costs. Champaign County is considering a switch to a new vendor for voter registration and processing. The county board is set to vote on the matter at its meeting tonight. The agenda includes a contract with 10X Software Solutions for voter registration and poll book software, plus two related budget amendments, $178,850 from the grant fund and $235,955 from the Clerk's General Fund. Clerk and Recorder Aaron Amons told the News Gazette that the amendments are to cover upfront the costs that total $414,805. He said some of the money is being requested from the grant fund because he said he expects that amount to be covered by grants from the Illinois voter registration system. He added that the grant fund is expected to completely cover the annual cost of the contract, which he said would total about $160,000 a year. The county's contract with its current vendor ends June 1st, and Amon said the new system must be in place in order to hold future elections. The voter registration system, for instance, is a system that we also use for when election judges are processing voters, he told the county board at a recent committee of the whole meeting. So the issues that we are discussing or talking about, things like the two-hour downtime that took place in 24, that is the voter registration system. And if we don't have that up and running, we can't process voters. When asked by a board member about the cost of the current contract, Amons estimated it at about $71,000 annually, with this amount also being covered by grant funding. The county's request for proposals returned two bids. Neither were from the current vendor. 10X was the low bidder and the more secure option, Amons said. He told the board that the company serves over 300 communities across the country. The City of Chicago's Election Commission uses 10X and their full suite, as well as Will County, which is one of the larger counties we have in Illinois, Amons said. And I have spoken with both of them. They are pleased with the services, the product, the response time, the customer service. End of an era in Illinois politics. After spending more than half his life in Congress, including the last three decades in the Senate, 80-year-old Dick Durbin announced Wednesday that he will retire at the end of his fifth term. U.S. Senator praised after revealing retirement plan. Following U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's announcement of his decision not to seek re-election in 2026, state and national officials released statements honoring the longtime elected official. Governor J.B. Pritzker thanked Durbin for representing the people of Illinois with integrity and honor. The people of Illinois should take great pride having a leader like Dick Durbin represent us in the U.S. Senate, he said. I have been proud to be his partner, and am even more proud to call him my friend. He will leave some extraordinary shoes to fill, and has given us all an example of courage and righteousness for the work ahead. No doubt we all celebrate him during his final 20 months in office. Pritzker also commended Durbin for being a champion for working families, civil rights, health care, and the environment. His fellow Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth said when she first met Durbin about 3 months after her Black Hawk helicopter was shot down in Iraq, she could barely sit up. But when Dick looked at me, he saw past the wounds, saw past the wheelchair, she said. He saw a soldier in search of her next mission, and he recognized well before I did that just because I would no longer be flying Black Hawks for the Army didn't mean that I couldn't find a new way to serve my nation. It is only because of Dick's empathy, patience, support, and mentorship that I am in the United States Senate today. She added that Durbin embodies what it means to be a true public servant. Durbin, who has served in Congress since 1983 and in the Senate since 1997, said in a video announcement Wednesday morning that it has been an honor to be entrusted with this responsibility longer than any other senator from Illinois. The decision of whether to run for re-election has not been easy, the 80-year-old said. I truly love the job of being a United States Senator, but in my heart I know it's time to pass the torch. So I am announcing today that I will not be seeking re-election at the end of my term. U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, Democrat Springfield, recalled serving as a volunteer on Durbin's 1996 campaign and said he has been an inspiration not only to me but countless others in public service. I know this decision was not made lightly, she said. Senator Durbin has led Senate Democratic Caucus with conviction and principle, especially in defending our democracy during some of its most trying moments. All members of Congress should look to Senator Durbin as a shining example of standing up for what is right and putting the people of your state first. Durbin said that he will continue fighting for Illinois and the future of the nation every day of my remaining time in the Senate. And Jim Dye's column, Now That Durbin Is Leaving, Dems Free-for-All Can Begin. What a difference a day makes. Just in an aside, that phrase would have made a good song title. On Tuesday, U.S. Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, was viewed by many of his party as a stubborn old goat who wouldn't get off the stage. On Wednesday, after announcing he won't seek a fifth six-year term, the 80-year-old was hailed as a near-perfect man who was a blessing to all those who had crossed his path. One example of the gushing rhetoric came from Governor J.B. Pritzker, a fellow Democrat. The governor praised Durbin's tenure and cited the undeniable positive impact his character and moral leadership have had on the nation, not just Illinois, but the entire nation. Dick remains a clear voice for truth, equality, and justice, Pritzker said. Just 3 weeks ago, Pritzker berated Durbin for his principled opposition to a proposed federal government shutdown in opposition to President Donald Trump. Pritzker called Durbin's vote an enormous mistake. The reality is that there's no love lost between the two men. But, as they joke in politics, how do you know when a politician is lying? His lips are moving. Now that the Durbin political death watch is over, it should be no surprise that Father Time wins again. Durbin doesn't want to go, but he's being ushered out the door by an irresistible force, the passage of time. Now comes the flood, the herd of overambitious and mediocrities who are vying to succeed Durbin and will almost certainly fall short of matching his public performance. The flood will result in a second wave. Those who seek to succeed the would-be successors. There's Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, the Chicago Poll. Former House Speaker Mike Madigan chose to run against a recalcitrant Democrat who had won Madigan's ire. And what about Secretary of State Alexei Janulis, who lost a 2010 U.S. Senate race to Republican Mark Kirk? He ran for Secretary of State to use the office as a launching pad for governor or the Senate. Then there are Chicago-area U.S. House members Robin Kelly, Lauren Underwood, and Raja Krishnamurthy. Krishnamurthy, who is from Peoria, was so taken aback by the Durham news that it took him nearly a minute to plan and announce a statewide campaign tour beginning today. From Chicago to downstate, Krishnamurthy to highlight how Trump's tariffs are hurting everyday Illinoisans. Another issue on the political agenda, who will seek to succeed the would-be Durbin successor by running a hugely competitive March 2026 Democratic primary. The Democratic political maelstrom will be hugely entertaining, but for now what's most striking is Durbin's career. He actually was young, 36 years old, when elected to the first of seven terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. Durbin had the good fortune to succeed the late Paul Simon when first elected to the U.S. Senate. The GOP then was in the early stages of its evolution to political irrelevance, foolishly nominating the eminently beatable Al Salvi in a contested GOP primary. Since then, it's been smooth sailing politically for Durbin. He stands at Illinois' most senior senator, having served for 30 years when he leaves in early 2027. That easily eclipses the record of all Democrat and Republican predecessors: Everett Dirksen, 19 years, Charles Percy, 18 years, Simon, 12 years. His tenure is greater than even Shelby M. Cullom, a Republican who served from 1883 to 1913, when U.S. senators were appointed, not directly elected. 12 states sue for halt to Trump tariff policy. Illinois among those challenging President's use of emergency powers. A dozen states sued the Trump administration Wednesday in the U.S. Court of International Trade in New York to stop its tariff policy, saying it is unlawful and has brought chaos to the American economy. The lawsuit said the policy put in place by President Donald Trump has been subject to his whims rather than the sound exercise of lawful authority. It challenged Trump's claim that he could arbitrarily impose tariffs based on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. The suit asks the court to declare the tariffs to be illegal and to block government agencies and its officers from enforcing them. A message sent to the Justice Department for comment was not immediately returned. The states listed as plaintiffs in the lawsuit were Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Maine, Minnesota, Nevada, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, and Vermont. In a release, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays called Trump's tariff scheme insane, saying it is not only economically reckless, it is illegal. Connecticut Attorney General William Tong said Trump's lawless and chaotic tariffs are a massive tax on Connecticut families and a disaster for Connecticut businesses and jobs. The lawsuit maintained that only Congress has the power to impose tariffs, and the President can only invoke the International Emergency Economic Powers Act when an emergency presents an unusual and extraordinary threat from abroad. By claiming the authority to impose immense and ever-changing tariffs on whatever goods entering the United States he chooses, for whatever reason he finds convenient, to declare an emergency, the President has upended the constitutional order and brought chaos to the American economy, the lawsuit said. Last week, Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom sued the Trump administration in federal court over the tariff policy, saying his state could lose billions of dollars in revenue as the largest importer in the country. In response, White House spokesman Kush Desal said the administration remains committed to addressing this national emergency that's decimating America's industries and leaving our workers behind with every tool at our disposal, from tariffs to negotiations. The teacher of the week, Jeanette Brosom, 4th grade, Southside Elementary School, Champaign. Students in Jeanette Brosom's class are rarely left without an engaging activity. Throughout the year, the 24-year-old teaching 24-year teaching veteran, and her students hatch chicks through the Champaign County Farm Bureau's Chicks in the Classroom program, sort themselves into houses during her Harry Potter read-aloud, make igneous rocks from Airheads candy, make volcanoes that erupt, and much more. While making students feel at home in her fourth-grade classroom at Champaign Southside Elementary the last 2 years, Brosim has also found her place. "Although I'm only in my second year teaching fourth grade," she said, "it feels like I have finally found the place I was meant to be. I find my work important because teaching is so much more than just imparting knowledge. Every day students are becoming better humans by working collaboratively with each other and navigating social situations. They are becoming critical thinkers when they engage in inquiry-based projects and class discussions. They are becoming conscientious citizens as they learn more about their community and the world around them. Not only do I get to see them grow academically, but I also get to see them grow as people. I feel so blessed to be a part of it. I became a teacher because I have always loved learning and enjoyed school. I had so many good teachers that made school a special place for me. I wanted to create that same feeling for children. I wanted my classroom to be a place that kids feel safe and feel a part of. My favorite or most unique lesson is the ones in which I can incorporate hands-on activities. I strongly believe that children learn by doing, and so I try to incorporate as many opportunities for experiential learning as I can. I also think learning should be fun. Yes, learning is serious business, but it should also be challenging and exciting and inspirational. My goal is to provide an environment where students are excited and happy to come to school. I love when I see them in the morning and they come running asking, "Ms. Brosim, what are we going to do today?" My most fulfilling moments are when the victory students have that I get to share. A student finally conquers long division, another masters the cursive Z, a student who struggles with self-control makes a good behavior choice. A shy student speaks up during a class discussion. To an outsider, these moments may not seem like much, but for me, these are the golden moments. There is nothing like the feeling when a student is experiencing something for the first time or mastering a skill for the first time, and they look up at you and smile. I keep students engaged by incorporating a lot of project-based learning. This year, we have built circuits, made salt dough maps of Illinois, composed dolphin calls, and made foam sculptures of sound waves. We made igneous rocks from Airheads candy, completed numerous math research projects. Can you name animals that have over 100 teeth? Created erupting volcanoes, and experienced the intolerable acts firsthand by paying taxes to King George, just to name a few. These types of projects help the learning to come alive and help keep students engaged in what we are doing. Something else I'm passionate about is extending learning beyond the four walls of my classroom. We are so fortunate to live in an area that provides a wealth of opportunities and experiences for students. This year, my students have worked with scientists from the University of Illinois' Beckman Institute on original invention designs. We learn about biomimicry from naturalists from the Anita Purvis Nature Center. Through the SPOT program, students submitted personal narratives to the U of I's theater department and saw those stories turned into live performances, and we have also been able to attend several performances at Cranert. Most recently, we participated in the Champaign County Farm Bureau's Chicks in the Classroom program and hatched chicken eggs. These experiences help students connect the knowledge they are learning to real-life situations. They make learning meaningful and magical. My favorite teacher and subject to study were, I have two teachers that would qualify as my favorites. The first was Mr. Thompson, my government and current events teacher at Newton Community High School. Not only did he make class interesting and relevant for students, he also showed me that teachers can show grace toward my students when they make mistakes. My other favorite teacher was my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Slover, at North Clay Elementary in Louisville, Illinois. We did a lot of really fun projects that year, and he read aloud most of the books by Roald Dahl, his favorite author. If only fourth grade, me, could see me now. If I weren't a teacher, I would be, although I can't ever imagine not being a teacher, I would probably be a party planner. My friends like to joke, give Jeanette a theme and she will be off and running. I think the skills I use now to plan and design units and lessons would come in handy when planning events. Judges urged to block executive orders targeting law firms. Two major law firms asked separate judges Wednesday to permanently block President Donald Trump's executive orders that were meant to punish them and harm their business operations. The firms, Perkins Coie and WilmerHale, say the orders imposed in March are unconstitutional assaults on the legal profession that threaten their relationships with clients and retaliate against them based either on their past legal representations or their association with particular attorneys whom Trump perceives as his adversaries. Courts last month temporarily halted enforcement of key provisions of both orders, but the firms asked in court Wednesday for them to be struck down in their entirety and for judges to issue rulings in their favor. Another firm, Jenner & Block, is set to make similar arguments next week, and a fourth, Sussman Godfrey, is set to do so next month. The entire executive order is retaliatory, Dane Butzwinkus, a lawyer who presented arguments on behalf of Perkins Coie, told a judge. The U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell did not immediately rule on the request, but repeatedly expressed deep unease over the executive order, signaling that she was inclined to side with Perkins Coie. She grilled a Justice Department lawyer over the government's plans to suspend a security clearances of lawyers at the firm and asked him to respond to the suggestion that the blacklisting of disfavored law firms was similar to the Red Scare panic over communism decades ago, and she pressed him to explain why the Trump administration was forcing firms to disavow the use of diversity, equity, and inclusion considerations in their hiring practices. Why does the administration view those three words as dirty? Howell asked. Justice Department Attorney Richard Lawson, who is representing the administration, said the president was within his prerogative to issue the executive orders, and the government had good basis to be concerned by what he called the unlawful evaluation by law firms striving to reach race and gender targets in their workforce. The spate of executive orders taking aim at some of the country's most elite and prominent law firms are part of a wide-ranging retribution campaign by Trump designed to reshape civil society and extract concessions from perceived adversaries. The actions have forced targeted entities, whether law firms or universities, to decide whether to push back and risk further incurring the administration's ire or to agree to concessions in hopes of averting sanctions. Some firms have challenged the orders in court, but others have proactively reached settlements. The executive actions have generally imposed the same sanctions against the targeted firms, included ordering the suspension of security clearances, termination of federal contracts, and restrictions in access to federal buildings for firm employees. Judges had earlier blocked the enforcement of sections related to federal contracts, but not security clearances. In court Wednesday, Howell said she was troubled that the administration was putting the cart before the horse by stripping security clearances en masse without first conducting an individualized review of attorneys. She appeared to grow exasperated as Lawson struggled to answer questions about the basic mechanics for implementing the security clearance suspension or the review process for the targeted attorneys. "You can't tell me which agencies are conducting the review," she asked at one point. "You don't know whether the firm or the attorney whose security clearance has been suspended has been given notice about the timing of the review, or whether they will have an ability to object to the review," she asked. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 24th, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.